Hi, everyone. Before we begin today's episode, just a quick disclosure. Our guest today is Brad Olson, co-founder and portfolio manager of Recurrent Investment Advisors. Brad is not affiliated with UBS, and his views are his own. Enjoy the show. Hello. Welcome to another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking, the podcast series by the Young Lockwood Sauer team at UBS in Houston. As always, I'm your host, Liz DeMontron. I'm one of the financial advisors on our team. For compliance purposes, our phone number is 713-940-2827. I am joined today by my friend and teammate, Barry Young, who's another one of the financial advisors on the team.
Hey, Liz.
Welcome, BY. What's going on?
Glad to be in the studio on a great day here in Houston, Texas.
I know, on a dreary day. Well, speaking of today, so we are recording this podcast April 2025, which I think it's safe to say has been a pretty historic month. You know, we've essentially had an upending of the global economic order post-World War II by the implementation of tariffs from the Trump administration. And while we've had a few weeks to digest all the movement and all the activity, I think, you know, there's still a tremendous amount of uncertainty, which extends to all different types of markets, but especially a global market like the commodities market. So we are so lucky to have our guest in the studio today because he is an expert in the commodities business. He's also one of my favorite guests on the podcast. So Wow. Let's welcome Brad Olson, co-founder and portfolio manager of Recurrent Advisors. Welcome back, Brad.
Thanks a lot, Liz. Thank you, Barry. It's fun to be here, and I hope whatever we talk about will still be relevant tomorrow or the day after, given how quick things have moved in the last few weeks.
Don't worry. We're just talking about religion and politics.
Yeah.
Nothing no offensive.
Good. A little holiday table fare. You know how they say on Odd Lots how they have the perfect guest?
I was like, going to say that.
We have the perfect
sure
guest
if Tracy
today.
And Joe would.
Yes, and I think he's our first repeat guest. So you're like the Alec Baldwin of Deep Roots.
Oh, great. Yeah, I want to be a five-time host, five-time SNL host.
No, it's like 17. It's like 17 times. And according to my energy expending AI that I looked up this morning to find that fun fact, I didn't know the most, you know, because they ask you other prompt questions and they asked what musical group or what musician has been the most often, you know, represented guest on SNL. And it's Dave Grohl.
Really?
No kidding.
Yeah. I was kind of, wow. And I guess it makes sense because he's been in many different bands and he's been on as a guest for other bands.
Yeah. I would have guessed Paul Simon because I think
know,
he's boys with Lorne.
I know you're a music fan, so
yeah,
I'm passing
know, yeah,
on
don't,
that.
Don't get me started.
So Alec Baldwin, Dave Grohl, I mean, you're all of the above. So you were on the podcast November 2021. So Wow. Lots has obviously changed since then. So would love to hear kind of an update from your end, what's going on work-wise and life.
Yeah, no, that dates me. Wow. 2021, what even happened back then? Yeah, you know, we've grown as a firm. We're managing about $1.4 billion all in energy, natural resources, and pipeline stocks, and still kind of a core group of us here in Houston. So we're still plugging away. And I would say for our sector, maybe not as much has changed as for the global economy broadly. But I think no matter kind of what your perspective is on what's going on right now, how much it gets rolled back, how much stays with us, I think the right framework or the framework that we've kind of thought about this with is you're having a growth shock, right? You're having an abrupt kind of reduction in economic growth expectations and a potentially abrupt increase in prices associated with tariffs. And believe it or not, although a lot has changed, we back in 2022, in the first kind of post-COVID inflation shock, we kind of had a framework for thinking about this and the type of environment we're in right now. And we kind of always say that if you put out a piece of research and it's totally worthless in 2 or 3 years, then you didn't think hard enough about it. And so we'd like to think that at least a lot of the research we put out over the last few years will continue to be relevant with all the wild twists and turns we've seen over the last few weeks.
Tariffs, inflationary?
Well, the way we described it, maybe just taking one step back, is coming out of COVID, you didn't know how fast the economy was going to grow, and you didn't know how fast prices were going to go up, but you had a hunch that prices were definitely going to go up. And whether it's the United States or any other economy, the one thing that we kind of focused on is that through history, when there's uncertainty about how much prices will go up going forward and how much the economy will grow, long cycle spending, business capital investment tends to kind of fall off a cliff in that environment. Mm-hmm. And ironically, when businesses don't feel confident in spending on factories and capacity to plan for the future, when businesses can't plan for the future, it actually makes things more expensive structurally going forward. We saw that in the 1970s when Nixon took us off the gold standard and imposed a bunch of price controls and tariffs. And that's kind of our playbook going forward, that your long cycle business spending slows down. People hold off on maybe the big purchases, and more of people's pocketbook goes towards the expenditures, the weekly expenses that you can't really avoid. Gas station, grocery store, things like that. Maybe less car dealership, more gas station and grocery store. And that's kind of a very 1970s dynamic that we've highlighted. And frankly, even if you think a lot of what the proposed tariffs get rolled back, uncertainty about the future and confidence in investing, if you're building a LNG terminal or a data center, you're looking at the next 9 months and saying, why would I be the guy who pays max tariffs before they get negotiated down?
Right. So you're talking about demand destruction in the very short run.
Absolutely. I mean, on a personal note, my wife got contacted by our local Ford dealer. She brought her car in for, you know, its regular maintenance, and immediately her inbox started getting flooded by like, we want to hold on to this car. And I'm economically interested. So I kind of, hey, let me text him back. And, you know, why do you want my car so bad? Well, we want non-tariff inventory. So we want recent used cars that aren't going to be subject to tariffs. Well, you've got to give me a car right now. Well, right now, nobody wants a new car. So I want to get you into a new car, and I want to take your two-year-old Expedition and have untariffed inventory. So even that kind of interaction gives you the idea that nobody's buying a car right now because they're a little more nervous about the future than they were.
I'll say.
And the car manufacturers themselves aren't going to build a factory or expand capacity because they're saying, I don't know which countries are going to have which cost structure. I don't know how much it's going to cost to import an engine or import parts. So yeah, those are the kind of two pincers, a slowdown in purchasing, but also an increase in uncertainty because of the, we can call them tariffs, but you know, if taxes or tariffs are going to jump 10%, it's kind of a squeeze coming from the top and the bottom.
I want to come back to that, but two things. I knew you were going to mention the 70s, which is like, I even called my dad to get his perspective recently because he came through the 73, 74, you know, inflation-led bear markets. And you have a lot of unique perspectives. One of them is you shared a lot of elbow time with Boone Pickens.
Yeah.
And I was curious, you know, I never had the good fortune to meet him. I've seen him speak a couple times, but I was curious, what do you think Boone would say about this environment?
Well, he definitely talked about, as a lot of oil and gas folks do, deeply skeptical of government intervention in markets and pricing. And Boone kind of would talk about, like, when the market was bad, they'd tell you just to not produce on Thursday and Friday. And you'd hear these stories that sounded kind of like from another planet, where the government would tell you explicitly what you could and couldn't do to manage the market. And so I think a lot of our conversations were kind of talked about the 70s, like a level of government interference that nobody would ever expect to come back. And so here we are, and you're kind of, we're talking to energy companies who say, like, well, I was building this LNG terminal, or I was contracting these LNG exports, but now Europe doesn't want to do anything because they're uncertain about Gazprom coming back or about Putin coming back. China can't do anything because they're being... So I think the level of government interference, ironically, you know, Boone kind of talked about that as like, we'll never do anything as dumb as price controls and government quotas ever again. And you kind of say like, well, there are a lot of things I think people would have said never maybe 60 or 90 days ago that are now
right.
Coin flip odds in today's markets and news. And so, you know, I think the way that we've kind of framed it, and I think Boone would agree with this, is in the mid 70s or the late 70s, Mobil Oil, you know, now part of Exxon, bought Montgomery Ward department stores. because they wanted to get out of the regulated oil business. They didn't want to be subject to government price caps or quotas. So they said, we're going direct to consumer and we're going to sell fur coats because oil is a bad business until government basically deregulates prices. And a couple of years later, you know, Jimmy Carter did take off price controls from the oil and gas industry that Nixon had put in. But I think these kind of herky-jerky government interventions that get rolled back and cause companies to do maybe less rational things with their capital, those are exactly the kind of, we haven't seen them yet, but those are the kind of things that, you know, I think Boone would be kind of regaling us with the story of price controls and buying department stores, which was going on, you know, when he was still very active in the oil and gas industry.
I mean, those behaviors, I mean, are they axiomatic of inflation? Are they reacting to inflation in that way? And do you think that the laissez-faire Republican-controlled, you know, administration in Congress, are they just replacing one set of, you know, environmental restrictions, which seem to be coming off, with these kind of tariff, almost market-related restrictions?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, frankly, for me, without wading too deep into the political side, this is the
most... That's okay.
Yeah. So
go ahead.
It's the most proposed government intervention in the economy that we've seen in, you know, over 50 years. And so when people kind of say, you know, laissez-faire, I think the kind of maybe the cynical assumption that a lot of folks in the markets have operated under is he'll say a lot of interventionist stuff. You know, Trump will say a lot of interventionist stuff, but he'll always do the laissez-faire thing. Like he'll kind of throw the red meat to the folks that want to hear,
sure,
you know, price controls, manufacturing is coming back, and he'll kind of do the free market laissez-faire thing. And now, obviously, there's a big question of like, maybe the first term was a bunch of laissez-faire people surrounding Trump who never let the true kind of inner Trump list of policies make it to prime time. That maybe there were guys that were kind of intercepting those passes before they could make it to the media. And this time we're seeing maybe a more unfiltered version of the plan. But I think what is absolutely true is in the 70s, you had a level of kind of tariffs and price controls in the economy that until recently we would have said, no way, we never go back to that. You had a decade of basically no GDP growth, no real GDP growth, and we couldn't get prices to go down. You had Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan basically enact a massive deregulation pro-investment plan. CapEx went absolutely through the roof in the late Carter, despite the fact the economy wasn't particularly good in the late 70s. There was all of a sudden a lot of optimism. You know, energy prices were deregulated. Trucking rates were deregulated. Like so many parts of the economy that we take for granted, airline prices were deregulated, created Southwest and a whole bunch of other independent carriers. You know, that late 70s, early 80s kicked off a decade when the economy grew like crazy and prices fell. And so absolutely, the more you invest, the lower prices get, the more competitive prices get, the less you invest, the more inflation you get long term. And so I think what we're going to be wondering or grappling with is we might look back on the first 2 years of Trump's term and say, those were 2 years when capital investment was artificially suppressed by a lack of certainty,
yeah,
and a lot of proposed policies that were very unfriendly, long bond rates going up as GDP growth falls. That's very unfriendly environment for investment.
Uncool.
Yeah.
Be cool.
Yeah. Everyone just needs to be cool.
Well, y'all have written a white paper kind of related to this, which I've read a couple of times. And if anybody listening wants a copy of that, they can go on your website, I think, and download it, or they can call us and we can send it to you. But it bears down on that idea around capital expenditure. And again, I'm going to steer it back to energy for, you know, since you're here, and what the longer implications of that are. And we're not going to talk about religion, but it does delve into geopolitics, right? And how are those things, the inflationary capital expenditure conundrum and geopolitics, connected?
Well, look, I think for me, again, I try to think about things, or we try to explain things in ways that will outlast the current batch of headlines. And I think there was a big fixation during the Biden administration on the level of regulation, environmental regulation, which, by the way, has been totally detrimental to manufacturing. It's been detrimental to clean energy, and it's been detrimental to oil and gas development. So a level of environmental approvals and regulation that clearly were anti-growth during Biden became a fixation. The oil and gas industry was fixated on getting rid of that or getting Trump elected because he would roll a lot of that back. There was never really a discussion about the demand side of the equation. So that goes back to geopolitics, right? If you're familiar with the United States, prolific energy producer, especially in the last 10 years, we have not grown our own domestic use of energy in almost 20 years. And so you say, well, we're producing a lot more of it. We're not consuming much more of it. Therefore, the only answer is shutting down coal, replacing it with natural gas. But once you're done with that, everything has to be exported. So everybody was very focused on the how many months to get a permit, how many years to build a pipeline. And those are very legitimate things to be focused on. But what nobody ever really toyed with was geopolitically, we've really benefited from a world that we were free to export to, and that geopolitically was taking advantage of U.S. exports to turn away from guys like Vladimir Putin and less politically reliable sources of energy. And I think if you talk to all the guys who were, I think it's fair to say that oil and gas executives were myopically focused on how do we get deregulation? And nobody asked the question of a more warm relationship with Russia and a more hostile relationship to China simultaneously eliminates your two biggest, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say your two biggest potential export markets are two massive continents, and you simultaneously turn off two continents on the planet by reintroducing Russian gas to Europe and by enacting 100% plus tariffs on China. And so a lot of folks in the energy space are kind of head spinning right now because, well, the good news is I'm not going to get held up by a ridiculous climate change 5-year environmental assessment. Well, that's great. But every single contract for the next 10 years, you were counting on it being really an Asian buyer or a European buyer. And you've basically crossed off every guy on that list except for, you know, maybe India, South Korea, Japan, depending on how those supposedly, those are going to be the first three trade deals announced, right?
Well, they're going to adhere to economics. I mean, they're going to adhere to pricing. I mean, wherever they can get the cheapest commodity, it's not going to be out of adherence or loyalty.
And I think the U.S. has a real claim that we are economically competitive. And maybe I think the way that a lot of these energy companies think is I want a portfolio of energy supply. The U.S. as a reliable kind of market-based supplier has always been a, hey, even if the U.S. isn't always going to be cheaper than Saudi Arabia, they are going to be reliable. They are going to be consistent. And so, yeah, I think the geopolitics, I think the energy guys are, you know, their heads kind of spinning. And I'll just say, like, I had a conversation with the general counsel, who I won't name, of one of the biggest oil companies in the world a few months ago. It was at a holiday party, so I won't say how many glasses of wine preceded this conversation. But my question to him was, my real question, it was December, so inauguration hadn't happened yet. But I said, what does the energy industry get, like, from Trump being elected? Because I understand there's a lot of permitting concerns. But frankly, if you're a $100 billion or larger company, you've got an army of lawyers that can fight all those permitting fights. But what do you really get other than, hey, my lawyers don't have to spend 4 years on a permitting, offshore permitting. It can now be 2 years. That seems like a pretty meager upside case for being
something as an eventuality, right?
Right. Yeah. And because, like, if Gazprom comes back, if we go into a trade war with China, which back then seemed maybe like a remote, but still possibility, and now obviously seems a lot more probable or possible, those seem like pretty big things to give up, like give up the Chinese market in exchange for, well, I can get pipelines permitted 18 months quicker. You're like, well, that doesn't feel like the P&L impact to any oil company is net benefited by giving up that and gaining that at the same time. And interestingly, this general counsel kind of, you know, looked at me and said, like, well, you know, we'll hope for the best and permits are going to get easier. And in the C-suite, there's kind of a big focus on pro-business, streamlining, deregulation. And that conversation to me was kind of like I couldn't help but go home from that party and kind of tell my wife, like, I really was hoping for a more inspiring answer in terms of what does the energy industry get from, but I think the unintended consequence, as I mentioned earlier, is that in a growth shock, when we look around the world, and we've done a bunch of these studies, which we'll probably publish in the next month or two, not just the US, not just the 1970s, but when we go around the world and say, when countries lose central bank independence, when GDP, real GDP growth slows down and prices go up because of mismanaged policies, there is a very persistent consumer discretionary. So big ticket purchases are usually your worst performing sector of the market, right? Because you're not going to buy a car. You're not going to buy a businesses aren't going to buy factory equipment if they don't know what the economy's future looks like. And energy is usually the outperformer. Like, even if you look at, and I'm not saying we're there, but Argentina, Turkey, when they fired their central bankers or pushed out their independent central bank,
sure.
You know, you lose control of economic growth for a little bit. You lose control of prices for a little bit. Energy does really well in that environment because energy ultimately is, the revenue is an international commodity and the cost structure is relatively better. I won't say better, but relatively better because you're in an economy where maybe growth is slowing, inflation, labor force inflation is maybe not as strong. You don't have to pay as much to get people in a slowing economy, and you're still able to sell an international commodity. And so energy, I do think, not for positive reasons, but in a world where people don't spend as much on kind of big investments and big purchases, they do spend more on groceries and filling up the gas tank and the home heating bill. And so energy does do better in these kind of growth shock, currency weakening kind of environments, which we're obviously not in like a Turkey or Argentina situation, but the direction of travel of what we've seen recently is the same.
Sure.
Even if the magnitude's not.
As it pertains to markets, I mean, there does seem like from our vantage to be behavioral tendencies, and like at the run up to the election and after the result, I mean, we were kind of going around with the bear case on oil, and everybody else was kind of, you know, red meat, you know, waving the flag and all that. And like, kind of, you know, wait, it's like not so fast. You know, you fast forward to just what, 4 months later, and we were pointing out that the gold to oil ratio is at not close to an all-time high, but just underneath the previous high that it hit during COVID. And it's like, I like to point out, it's like one of the most powerful forces in the markets is regression to the mean. And you have this, you've had this very quick transfer of sentiment that has been reflected in pricing. You know, I mean, it's not unlike the way COVID worked. I mean, but the other thing we point out is like, and I wanted to ask you, is like commodities in general, but particularly oil, they've got an economic input.
Yeah.
And, you know, where CapEx is declining, and okay, maybe the Treasury secretaries and the policymakers' ears, economy comes back online, you know, they walk back some of this stuff, yet this underinvestment period is already taking a hold. So we're like maximum, almost like maximum pessimism now, even though like the outcome is quite uncertain. I mean, about maybe we're going to go into some kind of recession, you know, by our own hand, but it's not set in stone quite yet.
I think it's a great point. I think when you think, again, just kind of zooming out and thinking about the variables, the post-COVID or the post, I know COVID ended at different times for different people, but I'll say the kind of late 2020 to 2021 timeframe, what was clearly a timeframe where the outlook was uncertain. CapEx, whether that's drilling in energy or whether that's building factories, slowed way down. And then the vaccine kind of created this jolt that got things moving again. But as we found out, when ships weren't available, when trucking wasn't available, when car dealerships were charging $30,000 premiums over MSRP because there wasn't enough cars on the lot. I think very similar today, when we talk to the energy guys we talk to, we've talked to LNG developers who say, we've got equipment that is only, you know, certain types of valves that are made in Italy. They're just made in Italy. And where they're floating in the Gulf of Mexico or Gulf of America, you know, these pieces of equipment are floating offshore because we think we'll get a better tariff rate in a month, and paying an extra month of shipping cost is way better than just accepting a 25 or 30% rate on the imported steel.
Well, I mean, that's a great point I haven't thought about, is that there are certain components in the value chain that are only made outside of the United States, very similar to like the semiconductor value chain.
Absolutely.
And you could spend an incredible amount of capital just replicating what already exists.
Well, that's exactly right. I think when people say, you know, hey, I'm reading headlines about OPEC, I'm reading this, I'm reading that, doesn't it make you nervous from an energy perspective? My argument is, if you wanted to say, well, why did energy underperform over the last 15 years? Tech dominance, strong US dollar, extremely efficient and innovative economy. You say, what's the next 5 years? I don't know exactly, but direction of travel would be weaker dollar, less innovative economy, and a lot of bulldozers and backhoes building stuff that's redundant. Not because it's better, but because we need a parallel value chain, which is tariffed less than the existing efficient value chain. And when you think about that, that's a world that burns a lot of diesel and moves a lot of steel around just to create what we already had in the first place.
Right.
And I think when we talk to companies we invest in and they tell us stuff like, yeah, believe it or not, like, you know, we get a lot of French pipe, or all of our drilling pipe comes from Austria just because they've always been the most competitive. I talked to a guy a week or two ago whose entire business is importing Korean drilling pipe to West Texas. And, you know, talking to him, I'm like, man, talk about, I feel like I know this industry. I've been here for doing this for a long time. I'm like, tell me about that business. And he's like, in term one, when we had, I'll say, still kind of America first policy making in term one, but tempered with a lot of expertise, he's like, we basically said to Korea, you're going to reduce your shipments by 30% to the US and we're not going to tariff you. And we went from being oversupplied with Korean steel to they immediately dropped their shipments by 30% because they didn't want to get tariffed. The new term two rules, the second term that we're dealing with now, is everyone gets tariffed. And I was like, well, so what's the impact on the energy companies you deliver that Korean steel to? He's like, they've been getting untariffed, low-cost Korean steel for the last 8 years. Now they're paying that tariff amount, and the US guys who are not tariffed are increasing prices to match the tariffed Korean price. Mm-hmm. So you're hearing stories all over the place where whenever I always ask the folks we talk to, what are you doing right now? And every single guy in all sorts of different industries say, I'm waiting. I think the deal's going to get better. And so, Barry, to your point about COVID, what did people do during COVID? They burned down all their inventory. They didn't do any investment. And then in 21 and 22, they hit go on every single button on their dashboard. And the economy went into this crazy kind of inflationary energy spike. I kind of think about it the same way, where at some point, everyone's going to say, hey, maybe we get 180-day tariff exemption. Import every last thing you might need in the next 3 years to kind of get us through this period of uncertainty. And that's going to obviously spike the economy in the short term, even if it's a less efficient use of resources in the medium and long term.
Yeah, one other note. I mean, I think you bring up a good point about productivity. And I actually, one of my few prepared notes to ask you about is in the oil patch, like the upstream part, who is going to service any new capacity that we try to bring online to fill the deficit? I mean, because if you do get a sudden demand surge, right, and, you know, some of it can be turned back on pretty quickly, you know, in West Texas. But, you know, it seems like service companies in particular, and this is my question, is that the business models have just been, you know, beaten down to such a point where they just can't go on any longer?
It's a great question. It's very timely. A large oil and gas producer in the U.S. came out with your annual investor update, and it was a very brief investor update. And it said, we're going to find $1 billion of savings in the next 2 years. To me, not to be too cynical, but whenever I see an update like that, it's like, you weren't looking for $1 billion like last year?
What were you doing before? Right. Is it the same thought, same thing occurred to me around Doge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we're going to start saving money tomorrow. What was interesting is, so I think like, all right, if you put out $1 billion savings target, it's not just all vapor. There's got to be something. And Barry, to your point about the long suffering, the service guys are the tail end of the whip. When everything slows down, they're like the car in the back of the pack that's got to slow down even more to accommodate everyone else hitting the brakes. And then when everyone hits the accelerator, they're scrambling to catch up. And sure enough, this $1 billion cost savings, the only kind of, I'll say, named specific item was, we're going to ask our service guys for $300 million break because everyone's cutting rigs in a world where oil is, you know, right around 60. And people don't, you know, necessarily appreciate how much the cost structure of oil and gas in the United States has gone up since 2020, how much, you know, wages and steel costs and diesel costs have gone up. So unfortunately, just whenever the planets start to align for the service guys, everyone says, I'm dropping a rig. I know everybody else I'm talking to is dropping a rig. I know you're going to have a lot of excess capacity. The least you can do, unless you want me to drop two rigs, is throw me a bone on pricing. And the service guy hasn't really had an upcycle in pricing. And so ultimately, though, Barry, what this gets back to is the same theme we've been talking about. Every time there's a herky-jerky stop-start in the economy's capacity to deliver things in a timely fashion is degraded. And ultimately, when people say, okay, give me the bull case on being bullish energy, you're hitting an energy sector that is kind of very lean, operating at very low margins, you're hitting it with these exogenous shocks. And then, hey, something happened in Iran. Can you deliver another 2 million barrels a day? It's like, no, you've had me kind of malnourished over here. I've been laying off my service guys for the last year. And now you're saying, hey, the world's actually back to needing. And you like, you look around the world because of what's been happening, Europe and China are talking about fiscal stimulus in a more concrete way than they have in years. And you say, this is still going to be a world that needs commodities, maybe more so than ever outside of the United States. And the U.S. is focused on staying lean and kind of getting through this down cycle, which I would argue an efficient market that has the ability to do long-term planning because policies are stable would not be firing service guys or demanding a 30% cost cut or a 10% service cost cut. Those are kind of things that are being imposed, and they're going to make the industry maybe less nimble or less able to respond to when there is an actual crisis and there's not enough energy available. I mean, we're seeing it too. This was the last comment I'll make because I know you kind of hit me on a, struck a nerve. 5 years ago during COVID, there were refineries shutting down in California, and Gavin Newsom said, good riddance. I mean, we're not going to have gasoline powered cars in California by 2030. This morning, April 23rd, this morning, Gavin Newsom and Bloomberg said he's putting together a task force to convince refiners to stay in business in California. And you kind of say, like, this is exactly what we're talking about. You make it hard to operate because whether it's left wing or right wing, you have heavy cost, heavy regulation, unclear future policies, people shut down capacity, the price to the consumer goes up, and then the politician says, please don't leave. Yeah. I don't want you to take your money and go. And it means that the next time there is a quote-unquote normal economy, whatever that looks like, I can tell you that in the next 2 years, there's going to be a lot fewer people upgrading to an EV because batteries are tariffed. And so you need those refineries to stay online. And so you have liberal politicians begging the oil and gas industry not to leave. But I think in the case of California, it's probably too late.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point and underscores the distrustful nature around and misunderstanding around market functionality, but also, and I think quite concerning, like the capricious application of law, you know, which seems to be coming more into the fore, but was there before that even. And, you know, where people are pushing an agenda. I have a good friend that's in the power business. He refers to it as picking winners. And is there a point in time when we relinquish these, you know, artificial constraints out of necessity?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that for people who love history, I think it's a super fascinating time because it does put in perspective that really, call it, until about 1970, the idea of the government being out of the economy was not reality. You know, the government regulated the price of so many different things. And a lot of that came from, you know, good intentions and consumer safety. But we kind of take for granted that we've been living in a 50-year period of steady deregulation. And I think it's kind of a wake-up call for a lot of folks that the idea, like even here in Texas, which is obviously kind of considered the Wild West of the power markets, when we had our power crisis in, you know, 2021, we had our winter freeze that took the grid offline. Right. You know, ERCOT's response to that, the Texas, you know, state regulator's response to that has been, send us a letter with a plan to build a power plant. And if we like the letter you send us, we will subsidize your power plant with kind of free or heavily subsidized loans from the state government. And you see, I think, Barry, to your exact point, anytime you have to ask bureaucrats for money to invest, it means that the incentives have somehow been undermined. Because a healthy system is not a, hey, I know you wanted to tariff everything, but I've got a steel-heavy project that's really important. Could you give me an exemption? Then it becomes a, who's the best at pitching their project in the hall?
Well, and that's why I said the capriciousness of it, mm-hmm. and it's unseemly. And I hope that that aspect gets remedied by market forces. And I know we're probably bumping up against an hour here, and you alluded to it earlier, but I wanted you to maybe finish a little bit on Russia and the gorilla of the continent in Europe. You know, and what a unique time in history this is to be revisiting a Cold War.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, look, I think one of the things that, as someone who spent a lot of time, I increasingly feel like I probably spent too much hours of my life studying Russia.
As you could be like a Fox newscaster now with your background in Russian studies.
What I will say is that living in Russia for a time when I was in college, like a great antidote to the kind of, you know, I'll just say the vague left-wing beliefs that many college kids have. It was a great antidote to a lot of those ideas living and spending time in Russia, right? Because Russia has always kind of been like the history, Soviet Union. I think even today, you sometimes read things online where people are kind of instinctively distrustful of the U.S. and the U.S. government, and maybe instinctively thinking that Russia is kind of an underappreciated good guy. But what I will say is that Russia was a great lesson in everything is go petition the Kremlin, offer to kick up 10% of your project economics to some sort of offshore slush fund that Putin or one of Putin's guys controls. And talking to people in Russia and kind of realizing, like hearing stories like, yeah, I would never open a restaurant. If it's successful, a guy's just going to pull up in a Mercedes S600 and tell you that he owns your restaurant now. And thinking as an American, like, wow, that's so depressing to think that any entrepreneurial venture is basically up for grabs the minute it becomes successful. And obviously, you know, there's a variety of folks that kind of created tech businesses in Russia. And, you know, as soon as they became successful, their assets were transferred to some oligarch who's tight with Putin, and they relocated to Paris or London. And I think it's the Cold War aspect. I kind of think Russia looms very large in American imaginations. Russia is a deeply economically underdeveloped country of 140 million people. There was a joke that, you know, back in the 60s or 70s, some famous American diplomat said that it is like Cameroon with nuclear missiles or so, something like that, which obviously is a harsh, but the reality is when you look at the history of Russia all the way back to the Tsarist times, with the Tsars and the serfs, and not to go too, you know, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy on you, but like with the serfs, you had a population that was systematically underfed so that Russia could export food to Europe and exert a lot of economic power by exporting necessary goods to Europe. And over time, Russia became less productive as a farming country, but much more productive as an oil-producing country. And oil and gas replaced the agricultural exports of the Tsarist times. And I think when you look at the position Russia plays, they play as big or as small of a role as commodity purchasers allow them to play. In the 70s, oil prices were high. They invaded Afghanistan. In the 90s, prices were low. The country collapsed. There was no adventurism. In the early 2000s, commodity prices bounced and they invaded Chechnya. In 08, oil was 140. They invaded Georgia. In 2014, oil was 100 again and they invaded Crimea. And obviously, you know, Ukraine has kind of been attacked like once the post-COVID oil rally really began in earnest. So I think one of the things I try to bring everything back to markets and economics because it's easier than understanding the very confusing personal motivations of a lot of these geopolitical actors. But with Russia, I guess I kind of view, I think there was a quote recently from, you know, the Polish prime minister, Europe is 350 million of the world's richest people asking for help against 130 million of the world's poorest people. And I think it's a very kind of real geopolitical in this kind of post-American, post-unipolar, whatever kind of geopolitical term you want to use, in a world where the U.S. is playing less of a role in Europe, Europe still has a big part to play in containing Russia's maybe more imperialistic ambitions, just because when Russia doesn't have commodity sales, they don't really have money to keep the war machine
so
going.
Just on that aspect, the economic aspects of them being an oil producer. I mean, you juxtapose that with the kleptocracy that goes on, which I assume hollows out their production capability.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you ask like, hey, this is a country in Russia that is poor enough that it's surprising that they occupy the same kind of, I'll say, inflation-adjusted level of prosperity today as they did kind of before the Soviet Union, basically, how could they remain so dependent on this export model that hasn't really made them that rich? And the reality is that commodity exports don't revolt when you tax them 100%. Mm-hmm. People revolt when you tax them 100%. And so for dictators, commodity export revenues will always be a more comfortable revenue base than business people and entrepreneurs who hate being taxed. And so I think the role that oil plays, obviously, you know, today we produce twice as much gas as Russia and about 50% more oil. And there's no reason Russia couldn't outproduce us in every way if they had 300 million entrepreneurs instead of 130 million people who are generally living in kind of what we would kind of consider to be like a Central American standard of living outside of places like Moscow or St. Petersburg. And so you're absolutely right that kicking 30% to the Tsar or to the Politburo or to now, you know, Putin's Italian villas, it has a long-term cost
or,
for sure.
Or going, you know, the lack of where they're fighting a war, I mean, that soaks up a lot of discretionary capital, you know, internally. I mean, nobody else is helping them finance that so much. And does that impede their ability to increase production?
Absolutely. Long term, when you look at the Russian economy, and this is, you know, you've got me on a bunch of interesting topics, which I apologize because it means that I'll be more rambly than usual, but I'll try my best. I mean, when you look at the Russian economy today, I know people are sick to death, and I'm sick to death too, of like the World War II analogies, but Russia is operating a German 1940s style economy where every single dollar is being financially engineered or just directly commanded to the service of the military. You know, the actual consumer goods in Russia are inflating, you know, the prices are inflating at 40, 50%. But it's not exactly a political environment where you can say, hey, the non-imported cheese is a ripoff and it tastes terrible. You know, like that is, it is kind of the beating people into a certain level of acceptance that like the average Russian person's like livelihood and economic livelihood has been inflated away in the last 3 years in the service of leaving a lot of equipment in the mud in eastern Ukraine. And the reality is a democracy is like a nervous system where you feel the pain points and you're alerted to the pain points because your people let you know and can protest and can vote against you. Russia, on one hand, you know, I kind of use the analogy like it's like a drunken guy in a bar fight where it's terrifying to know that he gets punched in the face and he doesn't feel it. But you also know that long term, this is really reducing his capacity to sustain the fight. Just swinging wildly in a bar brawl is not a sustainable behavior, but it is also terrifying in the meantime that you're like, nothing seems to bother this guy. Getting hit over the head with like a pool cue or whatever doesn't really faze him. So yeah, it's kind of a question of how long until the long run kind of takes hold with Russia. But the idea of Russia being a meaningfully smaller commodity producer in 5 years, unfortunately, as a portfolio manager, I can kind of hope for the best on that kind of 5-year time frame. And I think it's a very real possibility. But in the near term, it's too hard to call. But structurally, absolutely. You can't expand commodity production and fight a total war that's consuming a huge percentage of resources and population. You can't do both of those things simultaneously.
Great comment.
Well, I'm going to finish up. I have a question from our first ever mailbag from my husband, George. Hi, George. Brad, because you focus, you know, on the midstream space here in the U.S., what is the craziest thing you've ever seen MLP'd as a verb?
Oh, great question. So a million years ago, when the MLP kind of dividend paying tax structure was super hot, I think, you know, to George's point, there was a period of time where MLPs had such great returns and were such a hot asset class that various private equity and other folks were just putting anything they could into an MLP and claiming that it was kind of a pipeline like MLP. But there were fertilizer plants. So like converting natural gas to nitrogen fertilizer was an MLP. Frack sand mining. So when you think about like a stable infrastructure business, mining sand out of northern Wisconsin or West Texas is not what I would consider an infrastructure business. And I mean, I feel like the worst outcomes were usually international oil tankers with like 2-year contracts would get MLP'd and pitched as like a stable dividend investment. So,
oh my God, I'm going to have to one up you. I'm going to go with natural gas wells.
I mean,
and we can't mention the company, but there's one in mind. It just seems like that has got to be the poster boy of flaming out.
Yeah. There were a lot of, I feel like people are still getting over the PTSD of like those especially painful like natural gas production MLPs. But in terms of just like which ones were like the craziest, it was definitely the guys that sent the IRS the letter like, a client of mine is considering putting a nitrogen fertilizer facility in a dividend paying MLP. Can the IRS comment on that? And like, you know, that the IRS isn't a lawmaking body. So you ask the IRS and all they can say is like, we don't think we would prosecute you for tax fraud if you did that. And that's kind of the what you'd have to go on. But as soon as that happened, a bunch of people like readied their chemical and fertilizer plants to MLP. And it was close enough to the end of the MLP party that I don't think all of those actually came public. But there were definitely one or two fertilizer MLPs out there.
Yeah, I remember a couple that approached us and they wanted to MLP their convenience stores.
Oh, yeah. Was another.
That might be the craziest.
The gas pumps are MLP qualifying. Yeah. Selling cigarettes and candy bars is not MLP qualifying.
That's
it's
right.
Sad that some brain cells retain that information years later.
Well, I could go in easily another hour, so I can't thank you enough for coming to talk
thank
to
so
us
much,
in
Brad.
Such
this
a like
awesome.
Such an amazing time.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. It's always fun chatting and there's no shortage of topics right now. So I appreciate you having me on and it's always fun.
Awesome. We'll have you back before another 4 years pass.
Yeah. So, sounds great.
This has been another episode of Deep Roots Forward Thinking. This is Liz and Barry and Brad signing off.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC registered broker dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.